Jimmy, Jimmy Crane, Jimmy Crane's a nerd. Jimmy Crane's an improv nerd. Jimmy Crane's a nerd.
Hey everybody, this is Jimmy Crane, and you're listening to another episode of Improv Nerd, and we are sponsored by the 12th Annual Providence Improv Festival, which will be taking place September 17th through the 19th in beautiful downtown Providence, Rhode Island. The fest is now accepting submissions up through July 8th. The festival has hosted premier talent in the past from people from all over the world, including TJ and Dave, Jill Bernard, Dave Rosowski, Asif Ronan, Magnet Theater Touring Company, North Coast, and more. GQ Magazine calls it the coolest city in the U.S., and it gets even cooler as they host 3 days of performances, workshops, and after parties at their downtown theater space. It is a small city festival with a big city vibe. For more information, go to ProvidenceImprovFest.com. That's ProvidenceImprovFest.com. Find more information by visiting their Facebook page at Facebook.com/ProvidenceImprovFest. That's Facebook.com/Providence Improv Fest. Submissions are only $20 and it ends July 8th. Are you looking for a great headshot? Well, Brian McConkie Photography is offering a summer headshot special for you, the Improv Nerd listener. Brian has over 25 years of experience as a Chicago headshot photographer. And with this special, this is what you get. It's amazing. You get three looks for $325. You are saving $100. That is a $100 discount. This special runs only between June 15th to August 15th and does not include makeup. To set up your appointment, all you have to do is call 312-563-1357, or you can email Brian directly at brian@brianmcconkiephotography.com and mention Improv Nerd. That's brian@brianmcconkiephotography.com. And if you find yourself here in the city of Chicago in the month of July, I'm offering two award-winning artist-slow comedy weekend intensives, the weekend of July 11th and 12th and the weekend of July 25th through 26th. We limit these to 14 people, so you get personal attention. For more information, go to my slick new website, jimmycorain.com. That's jimmycorain.com. We have another great show for you today, but when do we not have a great show? You're getting tired of me saying that. Our guest today is Ithamar Enriquez. Ithamar is an actor, writer, comedian, who is an alumni of the Second City, where he was a member of the Main Stage, ETC, and Touring Company. He lives and works in Los Angeles now, where his TV and film credits include Arrested Development, The Office, How I Met Your Mother, Key & Peele, just to name a few. He was back in Chicago to put up his one-man show, Ithamar Has Nothing to Say, which was directed by Frank Caietti, and they put it up at the Second City Skybox. We talked to Ithamar about how he uses physicality, dance, and music to inspire his performance, how being anxious he uses to his advantage, and we talked to him about his wonderful show, Ithamar Has Nothing to Say, which is a silent sketch show, and how and why he created it. You are going to love this episode. He comes from a totally different point of view, and he's a wonderful improviser. Before we get to the interview with Ithamar, I got some really good news to share with you. Last week, I took my first stand-up comedy class. I know I talked about this on the podcast before, but stand-up comedy is something that I've always wanted to do. Like, even when I was like 10 years old, I was like, I want to do stand-up comedy. And then I got involved in improv, and I've been kind of distracted with that for the last 30 years. So I go to this class, and it's clear that I am the oldest person in the room. There's three other guys and two other women, and I am the oldest by 25 years. So I'm a little self-conscious about the age, but I'm more self-conscious about, like, I don't want people to know that, you know, I'm an improviser, I've been doing this for a long time, and I'm an improv teacher. Because what happens is, like, then it's like, I put all this pressure and expectation on myself, like, I'm supposed to be better than I am. And, but there's also a part of me when a couple of the, you know, when we did it at the beginning, I'm like, oh, you know, what's your experience? And I was very like, yeah, I do improv. I didn't say I was a teacher, but I said, you know, I do improv and I do this podcast, Improv Nerd. and a couple guys in the class who had taken improv classes. They didn't know me. They didn't know the podcast. So there's always that conflict in me. Like, I don't want to be noticed, but I do want to be noticed. So Randy, who's our teacher, really like him, you know, and he talked for like 2 hours. And in an improv class, if somebody talked for 2 hours, I mean, you would have gotten the hell out of there. But I was soaking it up. I just loved it. And he was talking about, he had these great anecdotes about Hannibal Buress and Michael Palasek and Beth Stelling. And they're all real successful stand-ups that started in Chicago. But the thing that I loved so much about the class was it reminded me, it brought me back when I first took my first improv class. And here I was, this like totally insecure, scared 18, 19-year-old kid. And this is before, you know, I was bitter and jaded and jealous and, you know, worried that people were passing me up or, you know, I was missing opportunities or I wanted to be famous. This is all before that. And you... When I got to my first improv class, there was this happiness, you know, this joy. And it happened, you know, when I was taking this stand-up class, I was just like smiling for the first half hour because I'm so excited that I'm just there. You know, there's like this relief that you made it, you know, that you've waited all this time and you've made it, you know. And it was just such a cool feeling. It really was. And the class goes for like 6 weeks. In our last class, we're supposed to have 5 minutes of material, and then we put it up in front of a live audience, our family and friends. So I will keep you posted. But before we get to this episode, I just want to say really quickly, a quick note. This episode with Ithamar was recorded at the Second City Training Center in Chicago. It's just a straight-on interview. We didn't record it in front of a live audience, so we don't have our typical live improv portion to the show. You're going to love his approach to improvisation. Here it is, the Ithamar Enriquez episode. Enjoy.
Jimmy's a nerd, he's a nerd, oh yeah. Jimmy's a nerd, he's a nerd.
Okay, you grew up in El Paso, Texas. What were you like as a kid?
Not very different from now. I mean, I was always just very playful. I was a very happy kid. My it was a very happy household. Mm-hmm. My parents have always been really supportive of whatever it is that we're into. So I really loved wrestling as a kid. It was wrestling and comedy were the two big things as a kid.
What did you love about wrestling?
The theatricality. And because I was not good at sports and I didn't really like sports, so wrestling was my sport because I saw these guys playing characters, being very theatrical, and still like athletic. So for me it was fun to, whereas a lot of my friends in the neighborhood like, let's go play football. Yeah, that was okay. But then it's like if guys were like, hey, let's play WWF. Then I was like, great, I can become a character. I can.
And even at a young age, you realize, oh my God, this is theater?
Yeah, definitely. Definitely. Because I think when my dad first introduced me to professional wrestling, he was like, it's not real. Like, mm-hmm. right away, he was like, this is all part of, they've planned this and these are characters. And that just fascinated me. Mm-hmm. And I was probably in the second or third grade when I found it. It just fascinated
me. And what was your dad like?
My dad was a very, has always been a very kind-hearted, really loving father. And he used to encourage me, like, you know, he used to coach me in t-ball and stuff. So he definitely always, like, encouraged me to play sports and try sports. But then he never, once he saw that I didn't really have an interest in it, he didn't, like, push it. It was always like, it's whatever you... He was the coach that was always saying, it's not about winning or losing, it's about having a good time. And he really lived by that.
Is that where you got... Because I always experience you as so good-natured, very patient, nothing bothers you. Is that where you got that from?
Mostly from my dad, yeah. I got that from my dad, and the part of my sense of humor that's very dry and sarcastic is my dad. And the part that's a lot more sort of like... outgoing, playful, and sillier is my mom. Because they both have a very, really wonderful sense of humor that both influenced me.
And your ethnicity is
I'm Mexican.
You're Mexican. Did you speak Spanish at home?
I did. Uh-huh. So I have an older sister, and we both only spoke Spanish. Mm-hmm. And then she started going to, so she started kindergarten. She was like in an ESL program, which is like English as a second language. Mm-hmm. So then her Spanish slowly started going away. So when she would come home and talk, I started, my Spanish started going away. So by the time that I got to kindergarten, my Spanish was gone, and it was all English. And now I can get my way around, but I'm definitely not like 100% fluent.
So then you study musical theater at Arizona State. How does a musical theater background end up helping you later when you come to Second City? And, because I think a lot of improvisers think, oh, I just improvise. But you had this musical theater background. How did it help you when you went to go write and perform in revues?
One of the things that I found with improv, and also just here in Chicago, I think it was maybe, I forgot which teacher told us, but it was, they said something along the lines of, when you are asked to be on a resident stage at Second City, you're expected to bring all of your tools, whatever you have in your toolbox as a performer, as a writer, as an improviser, you bring that. So if you play an instrument, that's expected of you. If you dance, that's expected of you. If you know puppetry, if you're a scientist, if you used to be a math teacher, all of that is what's is for your own use. So for me, it was, I really enjoy music. I really enjoy physical movement to music. So I was able to use that as a way to write scenes or to come up with premises. Because the sketch is, at Second City, is very theatrical, it gives you that outlet to not, I'm not just sitting at a computer writing a sketch that has a beginning, middle, end. I'm finding a way to make it theatrical, to make it live on
stage. So how would you approach coming up with a scene idea? Would you go home and turn music on and move around in your house?
Okay. Music's always, if I hear an interesting piece of music and it paints a picture in my mind of something physical, then that's where the idea starts. Or vice versa, if I find a fun physical movement and I figure out what that bit is, then it's like, well, what's the perfect piece of music that would accompany that? Because I remember seeing, we came to the Chicago Improv Festival, and I'd seen, I think it was Brave New Workshop. They did a scene.
Which is out of Minnesota.
Minnesota, yeah. They were performing that weekend. And they had one sketch that was so funny. That it was about sexual harassment in the office. And it was done to a song by Esquivel. And I remember listening to the song and being like, what is this song? Who is this artist? Found out that it's Esquivel, went and bought a CD, listened to all of his music, and I don't know if you're familiar with his style of music.
I'm not.
It's kind of like bachelor pad, like martini, like...
kind of 50s-ish?
Yes.
60s?
Yeah,
uh-huh. Kind of swingery?
Exactly, okay. Yeah. And he does a lot of covers, mm-hmm. but it's a lot of really weird. And there's kind of a Latin influence. It's kind of a weird... you'll find it in like the lounge section of a mm-hmm. record store. But perfect for sketch comedy. I mean, I listened to his greatest hit CD and I was like, this is just...
Perfect for sketch comedy, what do you mean by that?
It has a character to it. It doesn't take itself super seriously. So like, let's say he's doing, and I'm actually doing one of his songs in my show now, but like, let's say he's doing a cover of, Sentimental Journey, which is like a standard. His version's gonna be funny in just like a lot of times he'll replace an instrument with someone just being like zoo 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 zoo, like, and that's just over and over and over. Or he might put castanets where you used to hear a snare drum. Or he might put like a slide whistle where you used to hear like a trombone. It's just very, it's something that just makes you like, oh, this is interesting, this is funny.
So movement and music is what inspires you. Is that how you create characters too?
Sometimes. Physicality, definitely.
So will you start with the physicality?
If I'm creating a character, yes. I think that will usually help me find a point of view and then kind of working those together and finding something.
So give us an example for people that are listening to this podcast.
Sure.
They can't get enough of this kind of stuff.
Sure.
How would you, with the physicality, create a character?
One of my favorite exercises we ever did in class was we would walk around the room just neutrally. And then the teacher would clap. When the teacher clapped, we would have to shift our weight and start leading with another body part. So, like, let's say if you're just walking neutrally, he claps, you start leading with your pelvis, and you're just walking with your, just leading with your pelvis, right?
And you're immediately, your eyes bugged out, and your neck kind of looks like a giraffe. Like,
Sure. So whatever that is, so you start walking, and when you start feeling a certain way, so it changes your rhythm of how you're walking. It changes your posture. It changes the way your head's moving around. How does that make you feel? Who is this person? Who is this guy? Is it a man? Is it a woman? Why is he or she walking like this? Why is she taking her time? Where is he going? Is it to work? Is he walking around downtown looking for a chick? Like, what is he, what's going on? Like, even me just sitting here doing that, I'm thinking like, oh, this is like, what's, I'm here downtown. Like, let's get the night started. And then you think, well, what's a funny situation that that guy would be in? So this guy is always walking around looking for action, looking for the next thing. Well, maybe it'd be funny to put him like, on a Wednesday afternoon at 2 p.m., when it's just like people trying to have their lunch in a park.
Right.
And he's walking around being like, what's the haps? What's going down?
We're just here on lunch. We're just
Lunch. Oh, man. I love lunch. Hey, maybe we can, speaking of meals, maybe we can grab some dinner. You know, maybe this weekend, maybe tonight, you know.
Bart, you know, we got like 10 more minutes. We all got to get back to work.
Oh, I don't see time anymore. Time is, oh no, you're right. You actually have to, I have a doctor's appointment. I should get going. But hey, maybe tomorrow, you know, I'll see you under the tree, man.
Yeah, well, I'll tell you, we'll meet back up here under the tree.
All right, under this tree.
Yeah, this oak tree right here.
Yeah, I'm gonna carve my initials.
You do that. I gotta get back to work.
All right, see you later, man.
Yeah.
You looking good.
Yeah.
So yeah, you know, just something like that. Because I think sometimes when we overthink it, I'm always telling students, don't forget that you have a body up there. I get sick and tired of watching scenes, whether they're improvised or sketch, of like, we're two people looking at each other talking and trying to like think of how to make this a scene. You forget that you have a body.
Because I fall in that trap all the time, the talking head syndrome, and I think it's become even worse than, you know, when we started out. What do you think, why do you think that is?
It might be because people are afraid, people are really self-aware, or they're afraid of going there physically. They're afraid of starting a scene with a strong physical choice. People who I saw when I was studying were like, you know, Susan Messing, Keegan-Michael Key.
Scott Adsit. It was very physical.
I mean, all these guys who would just, even if they didn't know where they were going, they start with just some huge physical choice.
And what is the advantage of that? Because for the people that are in their head like myself and are, you know, what is the advantage of starting with a huge physical choice?
Gets you out of your head, and it instantly, at least for me, it instantly gains some sort of point of view. Because you put it out there, you then have to justify it. You have to find a way to make it.
You're pushing yourself off a cliff. Exactly. Is basically what you're doing.
Exactly.
Now, after college, you moved here to Chicago, mm-hmm. and you started taking classes at Second City. And you didn't take classes anywhere else. You didn't go IO. You didn't do Comedy Sports. You didn't do Annoyance. Mm-hmm. Why didn't you study at those other theaters?
It was really a matter of timing. At that time, there were a lot of students who were taking classes like at all three schools or at two schools. I just can't do that. I have to just stay focused on one thing at a time. If I already like, and I also didn't want to rush through it. Like, I didn't want to like, I got here, I got to take IO, Annoying, Second City all at once because I want to be done with all of them in a year. No, I wanted to take my time. I wanted to have fun with it. And I actually did take one Annoyance term after I started touring. And then my touring schedule, I just couldn't commit to it. But I was just, for me, I was like, I'll take as long as I want to. I don't feel any need to. So it's really just a matter of timing.
And when you came here and you started taking at the training center and then the conservatory, was it like, okay, I want Second City was my goal. I want to get on one of the stages?
Yeah, it definitely was. Or if not the stages, I definitely wanted a tour. That was the first thing, is I want a tour. Because that to me was like, that'd be really fun. Again, that's the closest I'll probably ever get to like a rock star schedule, right? It's like you go into a city, you do a show, you get praise you, leave, or whatever. So that
did
was
you get thing. That when you started a tour?
No, and then you realize it's not that at
okay,
all.
Okay, okay.
No,
you're
it's not
staying
that.
In shitty hotels, and you get $35 per diem. And,
sure.
Yeah.
But what is amazing about that that I didn't know is you make these really amazing friendships and bonds with people that you travel with. Because you're kind of forced to only hang out with each other, you just form these friendships. And friendships that are very influential to me now that I still have.
Like
Frank Caiati.
Who's directing your show,
yes.
And you met him in the touring company.
Exactly, like Brian Shortall, who I still collaborate with. We have a show that's been running for like 6 years in L.A. So that was great. And also, you in the touring company, you also kind of learn what works and what doesn't work in certain country or in certain areas of the country, like certain scenes or certain types of comedy. Or like sometimes we would have gigs where it was like, oh, this is a private Catholic school, so you can't say this, this, and this, and that. And this was like 10 minutes before the show started. It's like, well, here we go. And then you find a way to get around it. And that becomes a fun challenge as well.
So you're touring for a while, and then you go to Las Vegas.
Yes, I go to Las Vegas for 5 months.
Okay, which I think is interesting, because everyone who's played Vegas has always said, it's a different audience. And you're shaking your head, mm-hmm. and you're raising your eyebrows. Tell me how different the audience was, and what you learned by playing with this different audience.
So, basically, at least this was back in like 2004. It might be different now, but basically a lot of the audiences in Vegas don't want to be seeing shows. They want to be gambling. They want to be drinking. If they go to a show, they're either excited about going gambling after, or they're really pissed off because they just lost a lot of money. So that's the first thing. So they go to a show, they want to forget. They want to see the Osmonds, they want to see Cirque du Soleil. They want to see something where they don't have to think at all. What they don't want to see, what I learned, is political satire. They don't want to hear what we think about the current administration. They don't want to hear what we think about the economy. So those types of scenes didn't hit, and people would either just be really apathetic, really drunk. The theater we were in at the time, the only thing separating us from the slot machines was a thin glass wall. So while we're performing, you hear the faint, like, ding, 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 ding. Like, so there's an audience who just wants to gamble. They're watching our show, and they can literally hear what they really want to be doing right over the other side of the wall. So it was difficult at times. It was difficult. But again, that helped create a strong bond with the people I was on stage with, because we had each other. Like, guys, here's a battle. We have this battle. How are we going to get through it? And we did. And what was also fun about living in Vegas is that because I was there every day for 5 months, I was able to step back and look at the culture. And that was really fun too.
And what did you come back with thinking about in terms of the culture?
I think people, when they go to Vegas, think that it's like their free ride. Like, if I wanted to murder someone this weekend while I'm in Vegas, I can do it.
Right, right.
And then still go back home and live my life. People just went nuts. People went nuts.
I always felt there was a sadness. When you pulled everything back, there was a sadness about people who go to Vegas. Did you find that to be true?
I don't know. I mean, if there were, maybe they felt it, like, on their way out or at the airport or something. All I saw were people drinking and, like, doing... I mean, yeah, every once in a while you'd walk by and you see the person who has been at the slot machine since 1 p.m. and hasn't left and is just, like, you know, pulling the lever, pushing the thing. And as you know, like, there are no windows in casinos, because they don't want you to see what time it is outside. So even that was weird sometimes, because you couldn't tell what time it was. Also, living in Vegas, the last place you want to spend time is on the Strip. So the only time I saw people on the Strip was when I was walking in to work and walking.
So what did you do? Because you had a lot of time in between shows.
What was really nice is we worked at the Flamingo Hotel, and they would let all employees into their cafeteria and, like, eat whatever they wanted. So that's usually what we used to do. at that time, though, too, we used to, as a cast, we used to watch either new TV shows or movies together in between shows, which was a lot of fun, too. So at that point, at that time, the British Office was, it was like bootleg, like, oh, man, like, guys, Seamus got his hand on a VHS copy of the...
Seamus McCarthy, yeah, who was in the cast with you.
Yes, of the British Office, and we didn't even know what this was. And we watched it together in between shows, and of course, it just blew our minds. So that was fun, too, is like kind of a little bonding we would do in between shows.
When I hear you talk, to me it seems like the people are really important to you when you look back at Touring Company or Vegas. Or the people are... It's the people to for you. Where did that come from?
I think that just comes from my... I don't know. I guess my nature is very... I just love playing, and I think that it's very exciting to me. What's very fun about improv and what we do is sometimes you get to work with an ensemble, and it's just fun having that experience with someone. I get excited when I know I'm about to do a show. Even if I think the show's not going to go well, or if I look out in the house and there's not a lot of people, it's still kind of fun to have... to be like, this might be a crappy show, but at least I get to do it with you, and we're going to have a really good laugh about it afterwards.
Because my thought is about you is like, you probably never worked with a jerk or somebody who bugged you. Is that true?
Not really. I mean, it's not even like it's specific people as much as when you're thrown into a situation like a touring company or main stage in ETC, you spend a lot of time with these people. So... we all see the best and worst of each other during that time. Like a family. It's exactly like a family. Maybe at some point you're like, listen, like if you and I were in a cast and we've been working together for like 3 years, you'd be like, and I'm seeing you 6 nights a week. And I'm like, listen, Jimmy, I love you. You're great. I just can't be in this room right now. I'm just going to go eat an apple somewhere. I'm just going to like, you know, or like if we've been, you know, again, 3 years and you're doing bits and like you're kind of being relentless and it's like, listen, I need 10 minutes. Either stop doing the bit, or if you want to keep doing the bit, that's awesome. I'm just going to go get a cup of coffee.
Are you good about saying, I need Ikemar time right now?
If I need to, I will.
Okay.
But that's also pretty rare because okay. For the most part, I'll do the bit or I'll listen to the bit. Definitely. Or so, I might be the person being like, look, I have a bit, guys. Why is everybody walking away?
I need 10 minutes. I'm going to go.
Right.
Okay, so you're in Vegas, and then you get a phone call saying, hey, we'd like you to come back to Chicago mm-hmm. and be in the ETC.
Right.
At this point, was that even on your radar to come back?
I wasn't sure what was going to happen after Vegas. I had no idea. I thought my time in Chicago might be done. Maybe I'll move to L.A., but there was still a little part of me that really wanted to be able to write and perform a show in Chicago. So when I got the call, I was like, yes, definitely. I was going to miss the people in Vegas, but I also was like, if I was being honest with myself, that's what I wanted to do. I wanted to be able to...
When you say you miss the people, did you feel like, is it hard for you to say goodbye?
Yeah. Sometimes, because you just grow so close to these people and it's so fun. And then it's like I was the kid who got sad when school was done, not because of the school, but because I wasn't going to see my friends for like 3 months. Like I used to get sad, like school, like summer vacation. Usually people get excited, and don't get me wrong, it was, but I was like, oh man, I'm not going to see my friends for like 3 months. That would make me really sad as a kid.
And you come here to ETC, and Sue Gillen is your first director in
yes.
that show.
Mm-hmm.
And you said she was very influential. In what way?
She sort of taught me I'm trying to think of the word. Just kind of like I just told you how people forget that you can use your body on stage. She reminded me and taught me how much you can do in a theater with sketch comedy. So it's not just a sketch show. It is a presentation. It's an experience. It can look beautiful and artistic and still be very, very funny. She kind of... because up until that point, it was all about improv and sketch and what's the funniest and, you know, what's going to hit and this. And she kind of reinstated the idea of, besides all that stuff, which is very important, the show as a whole can also look and be really amazing. Don't forget that you're able to do this at it's in a theater, which is very different from film, very different from television. Doing it live, you may think that you're limited, where you're not. You can do so much and have it be a very unique experience that only the people watching in the theater are going to have, that they can't find on a screen.
So you do a couple shows at the ETC.
Yeah.
And then they give you a call and they say, we want you to do main stage.
Right.
And most people would jump at it.
Mm-hmm.
You're a little ambivalent about it.
Yeah, I actually, that's the first time when I was like, I need a couple days to think about it. And I think, again, it's going to sound like a broken record, but at that time I just found a really good groove at the ETC. I'd done two ETC shows. I'd gone from, in my first ETC show, being the new guy, the only new person from when the cast switched over, to my second show being the only person that stayed from that previous cast. So then I was the veteran all of a sudden, because then everyone else was new around me. So that, and that felt great. I was like, oh, cool. Like, I'm sort of the guy that they're going to, like, look up to and just kind of be, like...
the leader.
Yeah, exactly. So that was kind of exciting. And I had kind of gotten used to the schedule. Such a nice schedule, 4 nights a week.
And you make as much money as you do it used to. Didn't you make as much money as you would on main stage?
No, because you get paid per
show.
Okay. So you make a little less.
Okay.
I was a little like, I don't know if I want to do this. But then again, it was that thing where it's like, I kind of have to think back of where I was when I first got to Chicago and looking at the people on main stage and being like, that's what you're here for. And that's what you want to do.
So how do you make that decision? Do you call people up? Do you just think about it? How did you come
to it? I probably called maybe like my parents. Maybe I talked to, at that point, maybe I talked to like, I would have doubted if I talked to Frank about it. I mean, I don't remember right now, but maybe I did. And it was one of those things where when I was talking to people, they were always like, Ithamar, listening to you, you know you have the answer. You're just afraid to, like, admit it. You know that you want to take it.
What were you afraid? What was the fear part of it?
Maybe because it was new. Because I'd gone from now being, like, the established ETC veteran to now being the new guy again on a much larger scale. Now, all of a sudden, like, I'm expected to do something on the main stage. Back then, I don't think it's any more now, but back then, there was still a tiny bit of that residual thought of, like, minor team, major league between ETC and Maine. I think that's no longer the case. And even back then, it was not that much. I think I probably put that more on myself. But there was that thing of, like, okay, well, I was kind of able to get away with stuff back here, you know, in the ETC, and now it's like, oh, God, now I'm going to go to the main stage. It's a lot more people. For the most part, those are probably going to be the people. When you get average Joe off the street, that's what they're going to want to see first. Whereas ETC is like, okay, we're getting the people who either didn't get in or they know that it's a different show. They know it's a something smaller.
Was there also a part like, oh my God, I used all my tricks up back there. I don't know what I'm going to do up there.
I don't know. I don't know if I ever felt that. I don't think so, because I think I always, you know, I know that I get very antsy. So going back to how I was as a kid, that's also something that's never changed. I always get very antsy. So even running a show for as long as we used to here.
Which is how long?
It can go anywhere between, you know, 6 to 9 months. If the show's doing really well, it can go up to 11 months to a year. So even that is difficult because I never want to get bored with a show. And I never did. But going back to your original question, so I think that I knew that I wasn't going to, like, I wasn't tapped out.
How do you deal with your getting antsy? Because you go up to main stage and you do a show called Between Barack and a Hard Place. Mm-hmm. And I remember that show was like, wasn't that like a year and a half or something crazy it ran?
It ran for maybe about, like a little, maybe either a year or like a year and a month.
Yeah, I mean for Second City, I mean, this show was really popular.
Yes.
How did you deal with something like that?
Well, luckily, there were pieces in the show that were improvised. Obviously, having the set always helps because you know you're always going to improv
set afterwards.
And then naturally, people leave, so then someone comes in to replace them to do their parts, and that adds a different energy that you're like, okay, cool, I love that guy, but here comes this guy. Okay, cool, now we're going to figure this out, and now this will be fun. So this kind of feels like a different show because now this person's doing the original guy's parts or whatever. That being said, there'd be nights that were difficult for me where it'd be like, oh. And then I would rely, that's what I would rely on, like, well, this better be a good house. Which is never a good way to, that's a lot
of pressure. Why isn't that a good way?
Because it's not, I don't think it's, first of all, it's not a fair judgment. As the performer, you may think you know what's going on in the house, you will never know. Sometimes, and this is not even just at Second City, everywhere, sometimes the audience may have been super quiet, and you're just thinking, they hate this. And then you're leaving that night and everyone's like, oh my God, that was the most amazing show we've ever seen. And they're just like overly. So, and sometimes it's the opposite. Like, that sounded pretty good. And then no one looks at you as you're walking out of the theater or whatever. Like, it's just, there's no way of telling. And there's already so much going on in your head when you're up there. You need to not give yourself that pressure of also trying to figure out.
What are the things that are going on in your head when you're up there?
Oh, I mean, well, first of all, if you're improvising, hopefully it's just that you're listening to right. your scene partner, that you're staying focused in on whatever character and point of view you're playing, that you're locked in. Once you start listening to the audience and they're not reacting, then sometimes you start performing to get those reactions. And then that's when you slowly, it's what I call the bird's eye view of the scene. Once you're in the bird's eye view of the scene, you're in trouble.
So what happens when you have that bird's eye of the scene? How do you adjust and get back there?
What I do is I force myself to just take a beat and just listen and check in with my scene partner.
And when you say check in, just...
eye contact, make sure I'm listening to what they're saying, and then just kind of going from there. And putting the pressure off of myself that the scene has to be funny, exciting, interesting, unique.
Because it must be hard when you've done a scene over and over again and it gets a certain response and you're like, tonight it's not getting a certain response. I need to amp it up.
Sometimes you do that and then sometimes, and again, there's no way of telling because every audience is going to be different. Sometimes that works, sometimes it doesn't. Sometimes it gets them more upset because then it's like, you're doing more of what we're already showing you we don't like.
Right.
So stop trying to do more of it. Let's just get on with it.
In that show, Between Barack and a Hard Place, you and Joe Canale do a scene where you play two jazz musicians.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a high point for you.
Mm-hmm.
And tell us a little about that scene and why you liked it so much.
So in the scene, yes, we come out. It's like our last performance with these two old jazz musicians. And it's our final performance because they're closing down the jazz club that we're at. So it's a lot of back and forth. It's one of those scenes that can take a while because it's just Joe and I sort of bullshitting with each
right.
other. And then within the scene, we perform three of our favorite songs that we used to perform as a duo, but we get the song titles from the audience. So then we're improvising three different songs every night. And that was a really fun character because I tend to really love anything that's come before. So like anything that's like vaudevillian or old jazz guys, like old theater teachers, like all that stuff, I just love. I just love that.
So what did that character sound like? Can you give us a little sample?
Sure. it was like, good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the, I forgot what it was called, but it was like the Green Mill Jazz Club. This is our last show tonight. And, you know, people always ask me, what is it that's gotten you through this long life in jazz music? And I always say three things. My trumpet, heroin, and making sure my balls stay inside my pants every single night. So whatever it was, I've always loved jazz, and I was fascinated with sort of the darkness that those jazz musicians had, being drug addicts and these brilliant genius guys that really kind of led kind of crazy sad lives. But I think the reason why I loved it is going back to what you asked before. It was also the one of the moments in the show that made it, that was different every single night. So sometimes we had no idea what people were going to yell out. So it was fun to then come up with that song, those songs, to paint yourself in that corner to find a way to fight out.
Then you do a couple. You do a couple reviews.
I did one more. I think the last. It was between Broken Heart Plays and then No Country for Old White Men, and that was my last one.
And how do you decide to leave Second City? Because that's such a big step.
Yeah, I think you. For me, I remember again going back to Sue Gillen. I remember asking her once when we were in tour calls, like, "How did you know?" When she goes, "You just wake up and you know. You just feel like I've done what I came to do and I'm ready to move on." And that's kind of what happened with me. I also told myself I wanted to leave when I was still enjoying it. I wanted to be able to say, "I really love this job, and I want to leave before it gets."
Had you seen people? Because I know I have. Uh-huh. That stay too long. They become bitter, and there's an entitlement.
Yeah, there are a few people, or you'd hear stories about people who maybe they just weren't having a good time anymore. And this Second City was always such a great place for me, and I have and had so many wonderful memories that I was like, I never wanted to be that for me. So I was, we're in the middle of the run of the last show, and I was like, you know, I'm already telling myself, if I did one more show, it might be one too many. I could probably do it, but it might be one too many. So instead of seeing if it was one too many, I'm just going to quit now while I'm ahead and say, it's been wonderful, and let's see what else is next.
So you get up and you move to Los Angeles.
Yep.
And while you're in Los Angeles, you develop this show. That you've brought here to Chicago.
Yes, so this is, you know, 6 years later. So yeah, I go to LA. First year is real tough, just because I'm still finding my...
What's hard about it? Because everybody says the first year is really tough.
Well, I mean, I think the first year, my first year in Chicago was tough. Mm-hmm. In Chicago, I came out here, I didn't know anyone. I didn't have anything lined up except for classes. So money runs out. What the environment you're used to, both friends and neighborhoods and stuff, it's completely new. For me, too, both culturally and even climate-wise, it was completely different from Arizona. I went to school in Arizona. Going from Arizona to here, I'd never lived in a city this cold and in a city this, like, sort of metropolitan.
Now, did you make a plan, like, I'm going to save up so much money and then go to L.A.? Or you...
Yeah, and I thought I had saved up enough.
How much did you save?
I don't even remember, like, the exact number, but I remember thinking, oh, I'll be good for, like,
what would you tell people months. Today, like... Realistically, have this amount.
Oh my God. I mean, I would maybe say, like, if you want to go out there and not worry about having to find a job for like 3 months, I would try to save maybe like, I don't know, between like $5,000 to $8,000.
Mm-hmm.
If you're just going to go out there and just kind of like live off of it and not just until you get. Because as an actor, you. If you're making your living as an actor here, which I was, I hadn't had, like, a real job in a while, to go to L.A. thinking, I don't want to have to sort of, like, go look for a job yet. Well, that very quickly, the money very quickly disappeared and nothing was really happening.
Because you did really well here. I mean, you had got commercials, you'd gotten movie parts, mm-hmm. you were working at Second City.
Mm-hmm.
And then in L.A., did you have to get a day job after a couple months?
Luckily, I didn't. But it got really, really, really close. And thankfully, you know, I had friends who kind of helped me out a little bit. Not like financially, but they just sort of helped me out as far as like putting me up if I needed to like crash at a place because my apartment became too expensive or whatever. And then right when it got to that point, things just magically started picking up.
How did you keep your faith through that time?
I think because, well, first of all, part of me was like, I have no choice. Like, this is what I'm here to do. And also, like, I had representation, so it's not like I wasn't, like, auditioning.
Because a lot of people don't, that's a hard thing. There's people right. that we know that are out there that, you know, worked on main stage, mm-hmm. still don't have theatrical representation.
Yeah, I was very lucky in that, and that helped me. Moved to LA was I already had a manager lined up, so and then when I got out there, my manager lined me up with commercial agent and TV film agent. So I was definitely auditioning, and I would get a gig here or there, but even that alone was not keeping me too afloat. So I started to get really scary, and also I was spending more money out there because everything's more expensive in LA. And then it was also the first time I had a car. I got my driver's license when I was 30 years old because I was moving to LA. So
why hadn't you gotten a driver's license up to that point?
I didn't need one. I mean, but when I was in college, everything was close because it was college, and if we needed to really drive anywhere, my friends would drive me around. By the time I got to Chicago, I was like, I don't need a car. Why would I have a car in Chicago? And then when I decided to move to LA, I was like, oh, I guess I have to try to get a license. And I did, and I got a car, and thankfully that's been great. Driving's been great. If anything, people were like, it's good that your very first city to drive in is LA, because then hopefully now that means you can drive anywhere and not be afraid. So there was a lot of expenses and also you forget how expensive just moving is. And then great, you found a place you could barely afford. Awesome. Do you remember how you have to like furnish it and stuff? Oh yeah, that's right. Like you have to like get stuff for it. So it just, everything ran out really quickly.
Was it hard to, because you're at the top of the food chain here, you're at the Second City main stage, and basically when you go to LA, you got to start over. Is that difficult?
Yeah, very difficult.
How do you deal with that ego-wise? Because I would have a really hard time.
In retrospect, I'm glad it happened. Mm-hmm. Because it makes you... Another reason I think why I left Chicago and Second City is because I had gotten to a point where I was like really comfortable. And again, it's that antsy part of me again. If I get too comfortable, I start getting a little, I can't be too comfortable. I have to be working towards something. So that's another reason why I left when I did. And what happened then is going to LA, you lose that comfort. And once again, you have to fight yourself out. You paint yourself in a corner and you find a way to fight yourself out. While it was happening, I was miserable. But now in retrospect, I'm like, I'm glad I did.
I can't see you miserable. What is miserable like for you?
Miserable is...
not leaving your apartment?
Yeah, sometimes just blinds drawn. Maybe a lot of emotional eating.
Okay. I can relate to that.
Yeah.
But I don't see you as a mean person.
No, like, you know, like, I don't think... I've never like... lashed out to anyone. I think I'm pretty good about that.
Did you ever like?
But like sometimes I would like people would be like, "Hey, we're all gonna hang out here," and I'd be like, "I don't want to go. I don't want to go to this bar and meet friends because I don't want to get the question, how's it going? Because I'd been out there. How's LA treating you? How's it going? I didn't want to have to answer, you know. Because I think what happened with me was, like you said, I leave Chicago. And I go to LA thinking, oh, I can't wait to flash my Owls on Second City main stage card. That's going to get me into everything in LA.
You get free groceries at Ralph, up to $150.
Right. So, you know, I had somehow painted that in my mind, and it didn't happen. And it was a bit of a shock. But again, it made me hungry again. Literally and symbolically made me hungry again to keep working at it. And fast forward to this solo show I'm doing now, that also came out of the same sort of need to work on something. My solo show came as a result of being done with waiting for permission that someone else gives you to be like, okay, you can perform, you can act. Meaning, you audition all the time, you're leaving that in the hands of someone else. You're leaving, every time you audition, you're leaving your fate of whether or not you get to play in someone else's hands. So, and again, work has been fine. Like it's been, I've been now afloat now for like the past, you know, 5 years in LA, it's been fine. But it's not, for me, it's not like, some of it's not very fun, and I want to at least feel like I have a little bit of control in the matter.
It's not fun doing TV and film.
No. It is fun when you do it, but like, in other words, for me, it hasn't gotten to a point where, like, I feel comfortable both financially or, like, everything's fine right now, in 3 months, I have no idea what's going to be happening. And that's a little scary. And the jobs that I've been getting, even though they're great, they don't give you that security of, like, you're going to be okay in 3 months, in 4 months.
But I think also, too, it's a different... Like, I've done day parts on TV shows here in Chicago, and it's like, it's a job. You're really not expressing yourself like you're doing in a one-person show.
Sure. I think some of them, I think it depends on the gig. Some of the gigs were really fun. I mean, I've done a couple dramas, and the most have been comedies. And the comedy's definitely a lot more fun. I did, I was a recurring character on the fourth season of Arrested Development, the Netflix season. And that was just, like, so much fun.
What was fun about that?
Mitch Hurwitz, who's the show creator and was also the co-director for the fourth season, had a very... He was just very... He had that very playful attitude. A lot of times you get on a set, directors, you could just see that they're stressed out.
Right.
This guy, there was no stress. He was doing bits with everyone off camera. My first impression of him was I had gone in for a show that they did for Fox called Wild Kingdom with Will Arnett, and I had gone in to read for it and did not get the part. And this was like maybe 3-4 years ago. So then, and Mitch was in the room when I auditioned. So then we cut to Arrested Development. We're like three years later after the fact. I meet him on set and he goes, "Ithamar, that name sounds really familiar." And I said, "Oh yeah, I read for Wild Kingdom about 3 or 4 years." He goes, "Oh yeah, that's right." He goes, "Oh well, I'm sorry, but yeah, you didn't get the part." And I was like, "Oh, thank you." I was like, "I've been waiting by my phone." I mean, by this time the show had already been canceled, right. And so it was like he was doing bits, and that just left it all very, very light on the set. Same thing with I just recently shot a commercial that was directed by Christopher Guest, which when I knew that was going to happen, I was very nervous.
What were you nervous about?
Because he's, I mean, like a hero. Not just as a director, but as a performer. Hero. You get the sense that he might be like a little standoffish. That
yeah, he's had the reputation a little aloof, too.
Yes, exactly.
Right.
And I saw maybe a little bit of that, but still also very playful on a totally different level. He would do bits with you, but not even comment on it. So like
so you weren't
with
getting
a
straight reaction.
Face, it would just. And what was funny was I was at the wardrobe fitting for that commercial, and the commercial takes place with a bunch of dogs, and we're like at a dog's birthday party. So they had a bunch of our costumes laying about, and they had like a bunch of like costumes that the dogs would be wearing. So my introduction to him was he just walks up and he picks up one of the dog costumes, like a little dog, like a poodle's cheerleading outfit, and he looks at me and he says, "I'm gonna need for you to try this on later on during this," and like doesn't laugh or, you know, just kind of like straight. So I just look at him and I said, "Oh, actually I brought a bag of my own, so I'm fine. Like I have my own dog costumes to try on." And then he just kind of like went like gave like a little chuckle, and for me that's all I needed,
right,
to be like, that's it, this is gonna be the best,
right,
this is gonna be. So then on the day of the set it was great. So he was just so, the way he shot it was like, you know, we did one shot where we just went for like 20 minutes, just improvised. And then he would come in and kind of tell us what to keep and what to subtract, which is such a simple way of doing it. And that's how we're used to turning improv into sketch. And it was great. There was some stuff that he wasn't like precious about. There was some stuff he was like, "Try this and try that." And he kept telling us like, "Don't worry about, you know, take your time. We're not trying to fit any sort of like..." Because he was like, a lot of it's in the editing. So like, don't worry about trying to fit 30 seconds or whatever. Just take your time, have a good time. And it was like, that was another one of those sets and shoots where I was like, I don't want to leave. You cannot kick me off this set.
Because it was that much fun.
Oh, it was great.
Is there anything in the back of your mind? Because I would be this like, okay, if I do well in this commercial, I am sure. Because Jane Lynch's story, she did like some commercial with Christopher Guest, and then eventually he said, "Well, I've got a part for you."
Oh, it's certainly a hope, yeah.
How do you, like, suppress that during the shoot?
Well, you can't think about that during the shoot.
Okay.
During the shoot, you have to just do what's asked of you on the shoot. And while we were shooting, that wasn't going through my mind. I was just... What also helped was Amanda Blake Davis was on the same
commercial. Oh, I love her, yeah, yeah.
And we're really good friends, and we improvise together all the time. So that was, like, not only do I get to shoot with Christopher Guest, but now I get to shoot with a really, really good friend of mine who I'm so comfortable with improvising. We're only gonna make each other look really, really good on
this
set.
Because of that, do you pull her aside and say, I can't believe this, or my God, I'm nervous?
Both of us will just like keep looking at each other like, can you believe this is happening right now? Like, and then, so first of all, it's that we're both in this commercial, it's Christopher Guest, Anna Faris is also in the spot, mm-hmm. which is also kind of fun to have like a celebrity in the spot. And then during lunch, one of the guys comes up to us and said, have they told you guys when this is going to air? And we're like, no. They're like, oh, we're debuting it for the Oscars on Oscar night. And ABD and I just look at each other and that's like, this is never going to happen again. The circumstances around this the commercial is never going to happen again.
And then you do an episode of The Office and you're terrified to go into that.
Yes.
And what were you so afraid of?
So I was afraid of that because I had been a huge fan of the show. Mm-hmm. So I knew that I was going to be in a scene with most of the lead cast. Mm-hmm. And so I was just nervous.
Is Steve Carell still on the show or has he left?
He's already left. So my scene is with Ellie Kemper, John Krasinski, Rainn Wilson, Dave Koechner. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's all these people. And what intimidated me about that show was, whereas everything else in those other sets, things seemed to be a little like kind of loosey-goosey. Here it was loosey-goosey, but mainly among the main cast. And whenever, and I'm sure you've experienced this, when you go in as a day player, you're not part of that group.
No.
Not that they're doing it on purpose. No. And it's not malicious. They just don't know you.
If you think you're going to go in and be friends with them, it's the wrong way.
Right. And it's not because they're purposely leaving you out. No. It's just they don't know you.
They've got this rhythm and this mm-hmm. history, and, you know, it's stressful. They're doing 14-hour days, and you mm-hmm. come in and do one 14-hour day.
Exactly.
You know?
Yeah. So, and the guy that they put me with, I played a paramedic, the guy that they put me with was an actual paramedic. And he also kind of had like this nervous energy about him. So we were just kind of like off to by ourselves and stuff. And then, so at one point, we had to put Rainn Wilson on this like this stretcher that kind of popped up. And we just could not get it to pop up. So every time we try, like Rainn Wilson would like almost like fall off.
And are you going like, oh my God.
And I'm going, Flock like I'm sweat? Sweating, thinking like this is, I'm ruining this entire shot. Rainn Wilson's going to hate me. Like it's just like, I cannot get this thing to work. So then by the time that we get to the scene, like, I'm talking super fast, I'm not having fun, I'm not present. And I told this on Justin Kaufman's show the other night, too.
At WGN?
Yeah. During one of the scenes, the guy that plays Stanley, who I'd known, he just kind of, like, he just looks up to me and he's like, Ithamar, you're working way too hard. He's like, you're working way too hard. Like, just relax. And I'm like, oh no, now they're seeing this. Like, so it's not just me. They could tell that I'm really tense and nervous. And so that shoot was kind of a blur.
So how do you get this note, it's a high pressure situation, you want to do good. How do you make that adjustment then of not trying so hard?
Well, what helped was after they saw that we were struggling with it, they're like, yeah, we're just going to start with the stretcher already popped up. Like, you guys don't have to worry about popping up on its wheels. We're just going to open the scene with just Rainn Wilson's already going to be on the thing. So that helped, because we're like, okay, cool. So now we don't have to worry about trying to, like, make this thing work. So that kind of helped put some ease in it. And I think after that, it went well, and it was fine. And it just, I breathed my way through it, and it ended up being fine.
So tell me a little about where you came up with the idea of your show, Ithamar Enriquez Has Nothing to Say.
So the show, Ithamar Has Nothing to Say, it's a solo show that I perform. It's a solo sketch show I perform without speaking. And again, it goes back to, as a student, my favorite scenes in the sketch shows that I would see would be the scenes that had no dialogue.
Do you remember a couple?
Yes, well, the one that I described from Brave New Workshop definitely left it. An impression on me. And then going through classes here, the ones that stick out are in Slaughterhouse-5, Cattle Zero, which was a main stage show. There were two scenes. One was, I don't know what it's called, but it was Rich Tallarico and Tammy Sager get into a car, and the rest of the cast comes and they play the car. So like you have two people, you have one person holding up two flashlights as the headlights. You have two people being like windshield wipers, and basically Rich and Tammy, it's to a song, they're like drinking and they end up crashing. And whoever was on the front being the windshield wipers, all of a sudden they start blowing up balloons, so they're the airbags. And I just remember thinking, like, this is, like, again, like, to me, I was like, I've never seen this on TV or film. And here's a perfect example of someone using theatrical devices, which you can call it dance, you can call it mind, you can call it whatever, to bring music and comedy together and make it so unique and so funny. That specific show also had that ninja scene with all the acrobats. Remember the ATM ninjas? Where Sue Gillen as a ninja just kept doing cartwheels over and over. It also had a pirate scene with Craig Kakowski where he was a temp, and they danced to "What Would You Do with a Drunken Sailor?" What would you? So that scene in that show in particular, those all stuck out because again, it was music plus physicality and no dialogue. Because
I remember the one in ETC with Sue Gillen and Jack McBrayer and Martin Garcia.
Oh, Chairs!
Chairs!
Oh.
Can you tell us?
Yeah. So Chairs is a scene. They basically do a ballet. In office chairs. It starts like they're in an office.
With the rollers on.
With the rollers on, yeah. And that, I love the story about how that came to be. They were actually using the rollers for another scene. And when they were on break, Marty, who's a trained dancer, was just kind of doing the stuff in the chair and it was making everyone laugh. And Jeff Richman, according to Marty, Jeff Richman was like, go write that right now. So they came up with this.
How do you write that?
Exactly. And what it ends up being is it ends up being like dance. You just basically end up choreographing it.
I think Martin Garcia was one of the most underrated performers here.
He was such a hero of mine. Again, a very physical performer and someone that I looked up to and was the first person I understudied on the main stage.
Mm-hmm.
And I was still an understudy for the touring company and they had me understudy for Marty on the main stage. And that was like, talk about intimidation. Mm-hmm. And then he couldn't have been nicer and more supportive. And that cast was great, like, when I went in. But anyway, so those scenes really stuck out in my mind of something like, wow, I'd love it they can do that. So then by the time I got here, those are the scenes that I used to like to bring to the shows. Like, I wanted to bring those same types of scenes to the sketch shows, the ETC and the main. And I think every show I did probably had like one in there. And it was always my most favorite part of the show because I just loved it. Because it's, you don't see it a lot. It's still pretty unique. And again, I think people are just afraid to do that.
And when I saw Chairs at ETC, I mean, the crowd goes nuts for that. And to your point too is that could never be captured on television.
Right.
That could never be captured on film.
Right.
That piece was, you had to experience it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. And so I used to love doing those scenes here, but like I said, every review probably only had about one of those scenes per running order. So cut to, you know, a year and a half ago, I'm like, well, what's my next thing? I want to work on, I want to challenge myself for something. I just said, like, well, what's my favorite thing to do? My favorite thing to do is physical comedy to music. So can I do a solo show where I don't speak and I can play multiple characters? And I could present all these sketches, and I never speak, and I find some really great, fun music. And I knew that once I was going to do it, I knew the person I was going to ask to direct it, which was Frank, because we have such a great working relationship. We're really good friends, and I just trust him so much with comedy, and with also Frank, also a very physical performer.
Yes, yeah.
And it was fun, and then we both kind of just threw ourselves into this and found a way to make it work.
Why not speaking? What was important about not speaking in the show for you?
That's a good question. And I'm not even sure what it is. It's just... maybe because I know that it's... it's really universal. It's something that could probably appeal to a bunch of different people. I can't even tell you what that is. And also just because it's less about the speaking for me and more about the physical comedy. And, you know, going back to like growing up watching Three Stooges and like Little Rascals, that was straight up slapstick. Then as I started to like get into like Laurel and Hardy and like Charlie and Chaplin, that was slapstick, but it also had a lot of heart to it. And that was very interesting to me too, how, and that's something that you could also you can also really convey without dialogue because it's all emotion. It's all reaction.
But, you know, as I look over your resume and to research this, I don't see any, like, you, it's not like you train for this.
Right.
How did you develop this? The physicality, this.
A lot of it is probably like, you know, studying music theater, I had very minimal dance experience. I mean, like, very minimal. I would not call myself a dancer. And then I think just like anything else, just kind of like self-taught, just seeing, studying, not just people at Second City, but the people who were doing this stuff on screen, Rowan Atkinson, Steve Martin, Gilda Radner, and seeing some of these clips and watching them over and over, and just kind of going from there. One of the pieces that I still is, it might be my favorite SNL sketch, is, I don't know if you remember, it's the Dancing in the Dark sketch with Gilda Radner and Steve Martin. That was very funny, very sweet, had a very lovely like story there, and really, really funny. And I was like, that's I just love that. And I think it was also, for me, because it was so unique, because not a lot of people were doing it, both on stage or on film. That's what I think was also very exciting to me.
Frank Gaetti, who directed, he's a friend of yours, you started with him in touring company. I talked to him, and he said, this is what you're meant to do. When he sees the show, he says, this is what you're meant to do. I'm probably paraphrasing, and I'm probably sensationalizing. I hope I'm not. But he's like, when he sees you do this, this is what you're meant to do.
There was definitely a sense of, when I started working on this show and now doing it on stage, there's definitely a sense of a click happening of like, oh, I know I'm onto something when I can't stop thinking of ideas and I can't stop wanting to do more of this work. It still feels untapped in me, and I feel like I have a 50-minute show now. I can easily start working on another brand new 50 minutes because it's just something that I like now. I'm like super excited about developing and challenging and seeing what else can be done with this type of work.
And Key and Peele are producing a web series on this. Have you shot it already?
We did. We already shot the web series.
Okay.
And that was really fun too. And that became, again, speaking of what you can't do on stage, so the challenge there became, how can we transfer some of this to the screen? And I think we did a pretty good job. We didn't do, not every episode is based on something from the live show. We did, I think we took 3 scenes from the live show to the web series, and then we wrote another 3 that were completely original for the web series. So then, what became there was not now, what can we do, what sort of fun elements of film can we do that complements a scene with no dialogue? So then that became fun, of like what kind of camera tricks, what kind of fun, because again, a lot of stuff you see, it's going to rely on, we're shooting 2 people talking, then we cut to a close-up of the guy yelling, and then we cut close-up of the other guy yelling, like, again, it's sort of reliant on how what people are saying. So now what are the fun things we can do on film when you're just going off of reactions and physical and stuff like that? And I think that it's funny that a lot of the stuff that I do is very much sort of inspired by what you see a lot of, like, in Pixar. Like, there's scenes in my show that have been compared to some, like, Pixar stuff. And I think I think they both live in that same world of, like, finding ways to present this story with visual and not so much like dialogue.
Where are you hoping this is going to go?
I just hope that I have an avenue to keep doing this type of work, whether it's that I put up another live show, that it ends up becoming a TV show, a movie. Again, I just feel like it's not out there right now. I mean, I can't think of the last movie comedy that relied so much on physical humor that didn't have a lot of dialogue.
No, and when I think about what you do, is Mr. Bean is like the closest
Mr.
thing.
Mr. Bean, movie-wise, like, you know, maybe like The Party, Peter Sellers' The Party, which is like from the 70s. You know, so I think there's something there, and I think that, I don't know, I feel like I still haven't really cracked that nut, but we're working on it.
How did you get Key and Peele to produce something for you?
So, Key and Peele, I know them from out here, and they came and saw the show, and then we kind of had a meeting, and they said, yeah, And again, those two guys, also very physical performers. And what they've done with their sketch show is so unique in that it doesn't look like a sketch show. Like, I feel like all their stuff, they don't feel to me like sketches. They feel like short films because of the content and the way they're shot. So for me, too, that was exciting because I was like, I don't want mine to feel like a sketch show either. I want it to feel like short vignettes, short films, much like the shorts that Chaplin used to do or that Jacques Tati used to do. Like, they live in their own little... You know, Mr. Bean, even though you had a half-hour episode, they were all comprised of little vignettes. So it'd be like your first vignette, commercial, second vignette that maybe had a little bit of narrative between that and the first one, commercial, third. So it's kind of like what Louis does now on his show. I feel like Mr. Bean was much like Louis in that it was one long narrative comprised of a bunch of different scenes.
We've got to wrap this up. A couple quick questions. Improv has been such a white male sport for so long.
Mm-hmm.
How have you seen improv become more diverse since you started?
Well, definitely. You definitely see a lot more diversity in classes. Mm-hmm. I teach in LA, and I see a lot of diversity in classes, and it's very exciting. And I think that what's helping is when you see a lot of these actors and comedians who have an improv background coming up on TV and film. You see Keegan, you see Jordan, you see, you know, Sam Richardson, who's now also doing amazing.
Yeah.
And you get more of like, oh, they have an improv background too. Because I feel like a lot of the, especially in the 80s and 90s, a lot of the diverse comic actors we saw, for the most part, were pretty much all stand-up. They all had stand-up.
Right.
George Lopez, stand-up. You know, Richard Pryor, stand-up. Chris Rock, stand-up. And now you're seeing a lot of these guys having, like, Second City, Growlings, UCB. Like, they have an improv background. And hopefully what that's doing is that's showing students, you know, so that world is... There's a place for our voice in that world. I know that Second City has made it a point to make that known in the residence stages, which I think is great. The first ETC show I saw was Revelation Will Not Be Televised. That was a very diverse cast.
Mm-hmm.
Very diverse cast. And seeing that, I was like, oh, wow. Look at that. Look what they could do with that. And they're up there. Fantastic.
We've got to wrap this up. This has been so great. I really appreciate this. And we usually end our show with just one question, and that is, what piece of advice would you give somebody starting out in improv today?
I would say throw yourself into the world of comedy. Read every book, watch every movie, anything you can get your hands on, anything from way... I mean, I feel like I'm constantly reminding students... You have to see some of the old stuff. If you don't know who the Marx Brothers are, if you don't know who Buster Keaton is, and even less, like, if you don't know who Gilda Radner is, Madeline Kahn, Mel Brooks, you have to see what's come before you because you learn so much. And also, whatever, if your voice isn't being seen out there, put your voice out there. So, like, if what you love to do as a comedian is not anywhere, create something for yourself to put it out there so that people can be like, oh, there it is. There's his voice. That's what he does. And I think that's the only way you learn is really just by doing that.
Ithamar, thank you so much for being our guest on Improv Nerd.
Thanks, Jimmy. That was fun.
And there you have it, another episode of Improv Nerd is in the can. We're good, aren't we? I don't care if I have to pat myself on the back. I think we did. I think that episode was really, really good. I want to thank my guest, Ithamar Enriquez. And I love what he talked about, like, oh, he's into, like, older stuff, you know, like vaudevillian. And, you know, he really seemed like an old soul to me. And I also like what he talked about. Learn the history. Watch Marx Brothers movies and stuff like that. I really appreciated that. I also want to thank the Second City Training Center in Chicago for hosting us for this recording. I really appreciate it. And if you heard kids yelling in the background, it's because they were doing an improv camp, I believe, or an improv class. Like, I think, like, you know, younger kids. I'd like to thank my producer here in Chicago, Dan Schiffmacher. He's the one who makes me sound so slick and so professional. If it wasn't for Dan, you wouldn't be hearing my voice right now. If you want more information about me, Jimmy Corain, and my award-winning improv classes and workshops, and my improv nerd blog, go to my slick new website at jimmycorain.com. As you know, we're taking over social media, and we're doing this pretty cleverly, I have to say. We're starting on Facebook, and go to our Improv Nerd fan page and like us, because it really helps with my low self-esteem. And follow us on Twitter by going to improv_nerd. Also, check out our Improv Nerd YouTube channel. We're also part of a collective, a podcast collective called Feral Audio. That's feralaudio.com. Check out all their wonderful podcasts. People like Chelsea Peretti, Todd Berry, Dan Harmon, Matt Dwyer, Steve Agee. The list go on and on. I'd like to thank our two sponsors today, the Providence, the 12th annual Providence Improv Festival. For more information, go to providenceimprovfest.com. That's providenceimprovfest.com. And Brian McConkie Photography here in Chicago, who's offering this wonderful Improv Nerd discount. If you need a headshot, all you have to do is go to Brian at brianmcconkiephotography.com or give him a call at 312-563-1357. And who am I forgetting to thank? You. Thank you so much for listening, because without you, this would be nothing. And until next time, remember, walk, don't run.
Hello, I'm Kyle Ayers. I'm the host of Never Seen It, the podcast where comedians rewrite famous movies and TV shows they've never seen, and then we give them a read in studio. This is a clip I want to play for you guys from an episode where Langston Kerman rewrites Scarface. He's never seen it, but he wrote a script based on what he thinks he knows about it, and here's a clip. Give it a listen.
All right, Scarface, The New Frontier. Interior, happening discotheque. Remember when we called clubs discotheques? LOL, the 70s were crazy. Night. The crowd bustles with young, hot Mexicans who are supposed to be Cuban and all are dressed in butterfly collared shirts and pants that look like JNCO jeans and pleated khakis had a really weird baby. There's sex in the air and Poppy wants a whiff.
Oh my God.
Scarface, 22 to 45.
Like he's a television audience demographic.
Devilishly handsome. Not even a little bit Italian looking, so get that out of your dumb brain. Walks through the crowd with the confidence of a man who's going on MTV Cribs with the Ying Yang Twins one day. Does he actually have a scar on his face? Fuck no. Why would you even ask that? That's not important. What's important is that he is not at all a problematic stereotype and that he has come for his cocaine. As he approaches the red rope of the VIP, pronounced ve-a-pe in Spanish,
oh my gosh.
He spots his dear friend, who is almost certainly going to become his enemy by the end of the film, Smooth Skin. Scarface yells out his signature line.
Ciao, Bella. It's me, Scarface.
Oh, my God.